This is Forge Jam, and my guest today is author, publisher, former professional poker player, and disgruntled Jets fan. Peter Olson joins us. Peter, great to see you again.
Great to see you, Doug.
It was back in 2011 that Peter joined me as he launched, along with his colleague Amy Handelsman, the U.S. Poker Federation. But he's back because what he's always wanted to do has happened. He has published a novel. He's been writing for many years, and the acclaimed author joins us now on Sports Jam with his new novel, The Only Way to Play It, set against the backdrop of the underground poker world in New York City circa 2011. You know that circa well, don't you?
I do. I mean, I have been playing in the underground clubs in New York since the 90s. And, you know, I played at the Mayfair Club and the Diamond Club, which were going on, you know, I mean, the Mayfair had been around for many years and spawned many great and legendary poker players, including Eric Seidel and Jay Heimowitz and Billy Horan and Jason Lester, Howard Lederer and Nolly Francisco. And so I knew all of those guys. And back then the game was you know, in its infancy, really, the game of no limit hold'em. It didn't bear any resemblance really to the math oriented game that we see today, where you've got all these quants playing.
So would you like to go back to those days though?
I would like to go back to those days more than anything. You know, not only because the games were much easier, but it was just a much smaller world. So you knew everybody. When we would go out to the World Series of Poker, it was like an annual convention where you'd get together with the same 300 or 400 people, and you got to know them over the years. And you know, now in recent years, when I go out to the World Series of Poker, it's like, you know, it's wandering around a baseball stadium with, you know, thousands and thousands of people, none of whom you know.
A day of commitment. A day of focus.
Feels like you're bluffing.
A day of 1,000 decisions that must go right. The whirlwind that is day 5 of the 2019 World Series of Poker main event is next.
It's not as enjoyable for me in that way, in the sense of camaraderie, but it's also not as enjoyable to play poker with all these math wizards. You know, I enjoyed it in the days when there was more romance to it, and it was more intimate.
Arbitrary Press. You launched this publishing company recently, and with The Only Way to Play It, setting that backdrop that we've just been talking about, the underworld, you have your character, and he's not based on you. Your character of Nate, he's based on somebody who you played against. Mm. And so you kind of got some ideas. Set up Nate for us and why you chose him to be, you know, the subject of your novel.
So I had a friend who was a very serious artist, but he hadn't had real success as an artist. And like many young artists, he was trying to figure out how to support himself. And he had been doing construction and, you know, various odd jobs, and sort of fell into poker. And it was a revelation to him that he could make, you know, as much in a single night playing poker as he would make in an entire week doing construction. And it was really an ideal way to support his painting career. But then I watched as he was an incredible talent, although temperamentally he was a little shaky. He was a bit of a hothead, and that was his Achilles heel. But I watched him become really one of the top two or three poker players in the underground clubs in New York City, and then he got married, And very quickly, they had a couple of kids. And with all of the pressure and responsibility that, that fatherhood brought to him, I saw him trying to deal with that, and his game began to wilt under that pressure. And then, you know, I had been playing poker for many years, and I then found myself going through the same thing. And I think temperamentally, I was a bit better suited to dealing with that kind of pressure than he was. But I thought it was an interesting departure point for a novel to write about a character like that. I mean, you know, writing about a character's under pressure is always a good place to start any kind of dramatic story. And so that was the genesis of Nate. And then, of course, you know, you can't help as a writer imbuing the character with some of your own, the issues that you're dealing with. And so he was really an amalgam of me and this friend of mine. So that was how it developed. And it takes on a life of its own, you know, which is kind of that's the wonderful and mysterious and alchemical magic of it.
Look at that smile on your face. It was fun to do this, wasn't it?
It was fun, but I will say that it took me a good 10 years to write the book. I would start it, and I actually started the last time you and I talked. I had just started writing the book, and then the United States Poker Federation came along. And so between that and the responsibilities of being a parent, the novel sort of got derailed, and then I came back to it and I started it again. And again, it got derailed after working on it for a year or two. And so every time I would come back to the book over the course of this 10 years, it was almost like starting afresh. I would have to sort of work my way into it. And then finally, the fourth and last time, which was a few years ago, I think 3 years ago, I said, all right, it's now or never. You know, I've got to start and finish this thing. And so I raced through it pretty quickly. I did a draft in about 9 months. Of course, I had been thinking about it for all those years, so it wasn't that hard in many ways to get through a draft in 9 months. And after that began the process of reworking that draft. And among other people, I mean, my best reader is my wife, who is also a writer. She's a screenwriter and television writer, Alice O'Neill. And she's also just a great critic. And I really hand it to her for being able to step back from this book, which after all deals with a marriage and not always in flattering ways. And she was able to step back from it and really give me incredible criticism and ways to make the book better and deeper. And so I spent time doing that. And then I finally sent it out and found an agent, and the agent sent it out. And it turns out that the climate for publishing a novel is incredibly difficult now. And so I went through, I had many, many rejections on the book. And then finally an indie publisher agreed to take it on. I won't go into the reasons that the deal blew up, but it did. So on a Friday, I had a deal in place. Not only were they going to publish the novel, they were going to reissue my first book. And by Sunday, the deal had fallen apart. And that was kind of devastating. And then I found another publisher, another indie publisher, and I was gonna go with them, but the editor, who loved the book, actually persuaded me that I would be better off publishing it myself. He thought I would be able to do things that I wouldn't be able to do going through them.
Wow, an honest person.
Yeah, yeah, well, you know, he's a wonderful guy. I mean, we are now friends, and he has really he's really tried to be incredibly helpful with this book. But in terms of things like cover design and the editing process, I was able to do those things on my own, and to take control of that process was really a revelation. This has been the best publishing experience of my life, and I've had, you know, 4 books published by Big Five publishers. So, you know, I've gone that route, and I'm not going to say that those have been bad experiences. It's just this one has been so much better.
You've not only had a wonderful experience as a writer and publisher now, but you mentioned your wife, Allison. One of your proudest products happens to be your daughter, Eden, who's now 14. She beat you to the punch when it comes to writing a novel. In fact, Arbitrary Press has published her work. She's now on novel number 2, but her first novel, you want to just give us a brief description about that?
Yeah, so she started, you know, I mean, the truth is I had no idea she was even doing it, but she started writing a novel when she was 12, and she finished it just after she turned 14. Actually, I guess she was still 13 when she finished it. And she wanted for her birthday, for Christmas, last Christmas, what she wanted was a leather-bound version of the book. And so I decided before spending the money to get it bound in leather, I better have a look at it. And I read it, I was kind of blown away. I mean, you know, that my daughter at that age could write something that I considered so accomplished. And so I said to her, listen, maybe you would like to have this book actually published. I'm thinking of doing this for my own book, but I can start with yours. And she agreed to it. And so we published it. It's a novel called The Novice Twins. And the funny thing is she has zero interest in promoting it. She has kind of disavowed it, because she feels like she has progressed as a writer beyond that point. And I think it's an amazing book, but she no longer does.
She's going to be a tough critic of herself, right? Through the years.
She's a tough critic. And you know, it's funny. I mean, there are other writers, famous writers, who have done the same thing. I mean, Michael Cunningham's first novel, which was called Golden States, he won't even, if you bring that book to him and ask him to sign it, he won't do it. He wants nothing to do with that book. So, you know, I understand where she's coming from on that. And anyway, now her second novel is finished. I've read it. I'm working with her on it. We have both agreed that Arbitrary Press is her fallback. She actually would like to find a real publisher, not a real publisher, but a big publisher for it. And so we'll see. You know, we'll see what happens. I'm gonna, as soon as we go through the editing process together, I'm gonna pass it along to my agent and see what he thinks.
What great stock in Peter Olson's family. We're speaking with author, publisher, and former professional poker player Peter Olson here on Sports Jam. Talk about the stock that he comes from. His famous mother, 93 years of age right now, Barbara Mailer Wasserman, highlighted her tale of rescuing political prisoners from Spain in 1948, along with her friend, the writer Barbara Prose Solomon. His stepfather is Al Wasserman, the Academy Award-winning 60 Minutes producer. His uncle, the late Norman Mailer. Boy, no wonder Eden's got some, you know, got some drive in her and got the talent. So with that being said, are writers born or are they made? Can you learn to be a good writer, or is it inside of you?
That's a really tough question to answer, since I feel like for me, in a lot of ways, I was joining the family business, and for that reason was resistant to it for many, many years while I was growing up. I didn't come to writing really until I was 17. And I think that there are writers who are certainly more naturally inclined toward it and more naturally gifted than I am. I don't think that I was a born writer. I think I started writing because it was something that was done in my family, and I do have some talent, but I've also worked incredibly hard at it. So I think it is something you can learn. But then I look at my daughter, and she has a gift for it. She has a gift for it that both her mother and I are writers. Her mother's a very successful television and movie writer. And yet Eden seems to have been gifted with a storytelling gene. She understands story. When we would watch TV shows or movies together, she would always be interjecting and saying, here's what's going to happen. And it was uncanny. She always knew. I was just like, where does that come from? Neither of us know. How does she know? And she does. And she's also a voracious reader. So she's absorbed storytelling technique. And it's just part of who she is now. She just gets it. And I got to say, I'm envious, because for me, it's a real slog. I mean, I've learned a lot now after doing it for all these many years, but it's still something that I can't say comes naturally.
It was back in 2003 when TV host Charlie Rose interviewed Peter Olson's late uncle, Norman Mailer.
Norman Mailer is here. His first novel, The Neck End of the Dead, sold 200,000 copies. It made him one of the most celebrated post-war literary figures at the tender age of 25. Since that time, he has written more than 30 books. He has won 2 Pulitzers. He has directed 4 films, and he has written 10 screenplays. Well, what do you think is the biggest thing you've done so far?
I'd say Harlot's Ghost and The Executioner's Song and Ancient Evenings, those 3 books.
Are the things that you're proudest of and you think
I think in 100 years from now, if any of them is going to last, might be one of those 3.
What would Uncle Norman have to say, if he was still around, about your new novel? What do you think he would like challenge you on?
I mean, I'd love to know what he would think. I think he would like it. And I think that late in life, he became enamored with playing Texas Hold'em. And I think that he would feel like this novel gave him an understanding of the game that he hadn't had prior to reading it, that he hadn't gotten from playing it himself, that it would feel very much like entree into a world that he wanted to know more about. So I think he would have liked it.
You talked about, in your novel, the only way to play it, your main character, Nate, going through relationship troubles, going through economic troubles and all the pressures with COVID now. How about poker players having even more pressure than ever before? First of all, they weren't allowed to go into the casinos where, you know, poker is really prevalent now. So that would also lay another level of pressure, I would imagine, to their lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, what's happened with poker during the pandemic is that it has gone back online, and what's happened is that there are these poker apps have started up that have figured a way to skirt the internet gambling laws so that the sites are not actually running the games. The games are being run by people outside the games, and all of the financial transactions are settled outside the game, so that there's no money actually running through the game. And so far that has worked to sidestep the law. And so I play in a couple of home games where we play on one of the apps, and we settle up using PayPal or Venmo after the game, and it's all based on trust.
Do you get the same rush from online poker?
No, not at all. I can't stand it. I don't enjoy it at all.
So Nate would never go to online either.
Well, Nate in the novel, is forced because Black Friday occurs during the course within the novel.
But not on his own volition would he go. He was forced to do that.
He was forced to do so. And he had not been able, he had played some online and had never really been able to equal the success online that he had playing in live games. So he's forced to do it and doesn't really enjoy it. I mean, sort of mirroring my own feelings about it. And then eventually goes back to playing in the now deeper underground games that are more dangerous than they were prior.
Can you find those type of games still?
Yeah, those games are still going. I mean, I myself would not play in one now because of the pandemic, but I know that there are people, poker players who are all about risk assessment and taking chances, are willing to go and put their life on the line to play poker. To me, that seems absurd. But I guess, to some extent we were doing that playing in those underground games anyway, where there was always, the slight threat of something bad happening, whether it was, the clubs being robbed or the police raiding the games or whatever. And in fact, I write about this in the novel. I take dramatic license with it, but a friend of mine was shot and killed in one of the clubs during a robbery gone bad. And so I've seen that, not only the potential, but the reality of that. And I know what can happen. But as far as, playing during a pandemic, that makes no sense to me. And also I'm living in a house with my wife and my daughter, and downstairs is my 93-year-old mom. So I'm not going to take those kinds of risks and expose, someone else to it.
Let's say the pandemic passes, and boy, we wish that happens as soon as possible. Peter Olson gets an opportunity to play. It doesn't have to be for money. It's just for bragging rights. Who's the best opponent that you would like to play poker with? No family members now. This is for real.
For real. Oh, I mean, playing against the best players in the world is what's really fun.
You only get to pick one, though.
Just one. I mean, I've played against them. So I would say the most fun I've had is playing against Phil Hellmuth. Partly because he's the guy you love to hate.
Isn't this just classic Hellmuth? Call before the flop, check on the flop, and then just get himself into trouble on the turn.
Yeah. What do you got left there, Krill?
He likes to play the pot control style.
Is that 30,000 or $5,000 chips?
He doesn't like to ever put himself in a position to play a big pot.
God, what did I get myself into here? This is brutal.
And if there is one thing that Hellmuth is great at, he ends up laying this down. He can make a great laydown, can't he?
Yeah, he can. He sensed on the turn he was, not in great shape, but he just couldn't let it go for one bet, so.
There are things you respect about his game, right?
He's a good folder. He's a great folder. one of the best. But no, he's obviously got a lot of, things. He does a lot of things that we're not sure what he's doing, but he obviously has reasons, and he makes it work for him.
Tell us a little bit more about Phil. Some people are familiar with him. They've seen him on television, but you know, get a sense of who he's like and how he plays the game.
So I first met Phil back in 1989 when he finished runner-up to Johnny Chan in an event at Binion's. And I guess it was the main event. And I pegged him as an up-and-comer, and you know, I was pretty sure he was gonna win the World Series someday. And in fact, it happened a lot sooner than anyone expected. And I wound up writing a story about him for Details magazine. And I went and spent a week with Phil and his parents and his wife, and went to hockey games in Wisconsin and did all sorts of things with him. And I liked Phil. I thought that he was, I don't know. He was somebody who he was sort of born to be a poker player. He was lucky in that he found this thing that he did incredibly well, and I don't know what else he might have done with his life, and so he was lucky in that sense, and he had great natural skills at being able to notice inconsistencies and things. And so for a poker player, when you're playing a poker hand, it's really like you're telling a story, but you're also listening to the story that someone else is telling. And the ability to find the flaws in the story they're telling are what mark you, or at least in the past, have been the sort of crucial elements in determining your success or failure at the game. You know, can I tell if you are lying or telling the truth? And Phil was incredibly good at being able to pick up on very subtle, small things that would enable him to make the right play. I think there's probably no player in poker history who has laid down bigger hands than Phil in situations where the players of today would look at those and go, there's no way I'm ever laying that hand down. They would consider it a weakness, but for Phil it was a strength, because more often than not he was right. So I've played with him a number of times. I mean, the thing about Phil is that he thinks he's never supposed to lose. And so when he does lose, he tends to get bent out of shape. And there's nothing as much fun as seeing Phil get bent out of shape. So I think a lot of players, you know, do things that even surprise themselves in order to sort of throw Phil off the scent. So they'll do things that are just crazy. And then when it works out and Phil loses, he goes insane.
So Arbitrary Press simultaneously reissued your first book, Confessions of an Ivy League Bookie, under the new title, The VIG. And of course, you're the co-author of One of a Kind, a biography of poker champion Stewie Younger, and you wrote about Teddy Atlas. So could the new subject of maybe another biography come up against that opponent you were just talking about?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, you know, I think it's safe to say that after having written about gambling and poker for all these many years, I feel like this novel was the culmination of that. And I'm already moving on to other things.
Can you give us a taste of what that might be?
Well, I started a new novel, and it's actually, I guess, what they're calling YA, which is young adult, and it's about a 15-year-old child of divorce who ends up in a Cape Cod resort town for a summer, while his father has run off with a girlfriend and his mother is in New York City trying to figure out her life. And he's in this Cape Cod resort town trying to figure out his life. I've been back and forth on the book, but my daughter has read the beginning of the book and she is insistent that I finish it. So that's the plan. Although I've been very, very much distracted by running this press, and I am editing 4 books right now. So I just haven't had the time to work on it.
We understand that.
Yeah.
Taking a look behind you there, you have the cover of The Only Way to Play It. And right above that is a wonderful framed lithograph, I would guess you would call it, right? Can you give us the background behind that?
I can give you a little bit better view of it there. That's Stewie Unger. And it was a lithograph done by a guy named Larry Grossman. And it's pretty great. It's one of 200, and I don't know where the other 199 are, but I'm sure that they are in places where the owners are as happy to have them as I am.
Speaking of pretty great, let's talk about your 93-year-old mother, Barbara Mailer Wasserman. The memoir's coming out. Obviously, she's lived an incredible life. What don't we know about Mom that we should know?
Well, you know, I think for her, growing up with her famous brother, Norman Mailer, I would call it a blessing and a curse. She would only call it a blessing. They were incredibly close. But you know, she's somebody who's really talented in her own right. And I think in some ways she buried that side of herself for many years. And so for me to see her finally, you know, sort of letting her light shine out from under that barrel is exciting. And it's not a traditional memoir. It's more written as a series of stories, interconnecting stories. I'm learning things about her that I didn't know. And so for me, it's great in that way. And I'm also her editor on the book. So we are going through the editorial process right now. And I'm doing to her what has been done to me by various people, most particularly my wife, which is I keep sort of pushing her and trying to get her to dig deeper on things and go deeper. And she's not always happy about that. But I've said to her, Mom, you know, if you aren't around when this book finally comes out, I'm going to be the one who has the final say. So yeah, why don't you do the things you want to do to it now while you know, so she thinks that's pretty funny.
What amazing little nugget did you learn that, you know, that surprised you the most?
Let's see. What nugget did I learn that surprised me the most? I guess that she tells a story about having an affair with a much older man when she was in her very early 20s. And I had never heard the story. I didn't know it. And it was kind of a revelation to me. And I've only read now through, I'd say, the first quarter of the book. So I expect that I'm going to find out more things along the way that I didn't know about.
You don't have much time on your hands, so maybe it's better the Jets are probably not part of your regular schedule. Are you still watching them every Sunday?
Very little. And I also, because I'm so busy, last year I was way into fantasy football and, in fact, won my league. And this year I dropped out of the league because I didn't want to spend that kind of time. I didn't want to do it if I wasn't going to do it to win. And to win one of those things, you actually have to put in a lot of time. So yeah, I have a lot more time on Sundays to do my work. But I still, you know, I'm not watching the Jets, but I'm still watching the good game of the week. So I'll be watching the Kansas City Buffalo game tonight.
What must be really exciting for you is that this whole family situation that you have right now, with everybody intertwined in basically your whole publishing business and writing, and everybody's connected. I can imagine you have disagreements on things that you talk about and things like that, but just how close this family must be at this point to really have tremendously deep conversations that a lot of people regret they don't have a chance to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of, it's a lot of fun, and it's also at times painful. But you know, at our dinner table, we talk a lot about story, and we come up with stories, things that, that we might want to collaborate on. That hasn't happened yet, but we love coming up with ideas for things. And so that's, you know, that's a great way for us to all stay connected.
One more thing that you want to say about Nate Fisher, who is the subject of your new novel, The Only Way to Play It. Did he morph in your mind through all these years, or did you have pretty much a strong beginning and ending for him the whole time?
You know, as the years went by, there were certainly things that changed from their initial conceptions. There were events that happened that changed. I mean, one thing was when I first started working on this book, it was before Black Friday. And so when Black Friday came along and the poker world, you know, changed dramatically, I thought, I've got to work that into the book. And so I did. But the character of Nate, I think, was he evolved in the way that all characters evolve. You know, you hope as you're working on a book to be surprised. And Nate did do things at various turns that surprised me. But as far as where the book was going to end up, without giving anything away, I wasn't sure in the end what his relationship to poker was going to be. And I was a little bit surprised by where his relationship with poker ended up. Which anyone who reads the book will find out. But that was definitely a surprise to me.
And without giving anything away from the book's plot, his father will have a big decision or a big role in everything that turns out for Nate.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing that I really wanted to write about, the whole idea of legacy and what a father's life and actions, how they fall on a child, and what, you know, what are choices that we have as the child of someone, and what are things that are just sort of given to us to sort of relive or work out in better ways. I mean, I know in my own relationship with my dad, he ultimately, and you know, God love him, but he was a failed writer, and so you could say it was insane for me to sort of try and pick up the torch and carry it for him, but I did that, and it's been a struggle at various points, but I feel like in some ways I was able to do this thing that he always wanted to do, and I think that, you know, that would have made him very happy. But there were also, you know, other things that were part of his life that I took on and tried to either improve his results or in some cases tried not to relive. So, you know, he and my mom got divorced. I think one of the reasons I waited so long to get married was that I didn't want to take the chance of reliving that, of visiting that on my child. And so that has had a lot to do with my parenting and also my determination to keep my family together through whatever.
And you lost your dad about 3 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
As I told you before we started this, you know, I lost my dad in May, and being married for 70 years plus, I knew I was never going to get there not on that end. So he didn't pass those genes along. But just like you said, when I interviewed him, I learned so much about him that wasn't necessarily I didn't know, but there were certain things that I didn't know meant so much to him. Very, very kept a lot of things to himself. But, you know, this book, this novel that you have put together, The Only Way to Play It, I know it's been a labor of love, and I can almost feel that love that's coming from that place that you're sitting in right now, because what a family guy you are now. And it's so much, so exciting to talk to you about this. We wish you the best of luck with the novel and the rest of your career, as well as your daughters, as your wife, and now with the memoir coming out for your mom. So what a family affair, and congratulations. Thanks for joining us on Sports Jam.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to WBGO.org/SportsJam. Find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on the NPR list of podcasts and on iTunes. Peter Olson's The Only Way to Play It is available in hardcover, paperback, ebook, and audiobook versions via Amazon. You can find out more about Peter Olson and his other books at peterolson.com. Until our next Sports Jam session, I hope to see you at the game.